And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning and welcome. It's so good to be back and with you this morning. For those listening by streaming on the web at WDEVradio.com, welcome no matter where you are or what time zone you're in, all over the world. And of course, you can find us on the dial at 550 AM or 96.1 FM, 96.5 FM, or 101.9 FM. If you wish to join our conversation today, the call-in number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. As promised on Friday, I said I'd open up the phone lines, and today on Open Mic, what we'll do is open up the phone lines for calls for the first hour with a brief discussion with Rick Carlson, who's promoting a film called My Father's Vietnam, airing tomorrow in Burlington, and a book entitled Crazy Frenzy, One Man's Vietnam War. And in the second hour, we'll speak with Dennis O'Brien from the group Concern Catholics of Vermont about issues that are important to them. So I want to throw out four subjects in the news that I read over the weekend. Get your opinions or comments if you're interested in these subjects. First up, what I want to go to is the Vermont State Employees Association. And I just want your impression, your opinions about what's going on there. Over the weekend, I was sent what was purported to be internal documents through the email. I was asked not to disclose these documents that came to me. But I can't discuss the issue without disclosing that I have these documents. And my bet is that most other reporters in the state and there are others in the state, including reporters, that also have these documents. And in essence, what the document said is that it's an indictment on the leadership of Steve Howard, the organization's executive director. The documents, in essence, call him autocratic, inconsistent with decision-making, and belittling to those that disagree with him. Folks, this is a mess. Employees have cast a no-confidence vote. And as much as I disagree at times with the VSEA, this serves no one's purpose. And it's kind of sad to see and unfortunate to see that this organization seems to be in chaos. And like I said, there are many times when I may disagree with this organization, but state employees are, for the most part, hard workers and dedicated in their activities to public service, and they deserve to be represented by an organization that is not in chaos. So would be interested in your opinion about what should happen here. Of course, it may not be Steve Howard's fault. Two times this organization has turned against the executive director, and one has to ask, is it the executive director or is it the organization itself that is out of control? Would welcome your phone calls on your opinion. So what is your opinion about what should happen here? What do you think is going on? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Be very, very interested in your phone calls, especially from state employees. And also from state employees, I'd like to hear from you about this subject. Ken from South Burlington brought this up last week, and he raised the issue that more and more managers are becoming political appointees and are not very good managers. Be interested in your opinion, particularly state employees. Again, more directors, not political appointees. Ken's comments were that political appointees are there to carry out the message and the agenda of the governor, and may not have the background that other directors may have that are career employees, and also may not be looking out for the welfare of state employees the way that a director who has been in the system for a long time would. So I'm asking for your opinions on the Vermont State Employees Association controversy. There's been a no a no confidence vote in their executive director, Steve Howard. And then you have to ask yourself, is it Steve Howard or is it the organization? Because they have turned against a previous executive director. And one has to ask, is it actually the executive director's fault, or is it an organization out of control? So let's go to Whit in South Carolina. Whit, you're on open mic.
Yes, hello.
Great. Good morning.
How are you?
Great, thank you.
Have you calmed down yet?
I've always calmed, Whit.
Oh, no. Well, anyway, I don't want to start an argument. What I wanted to do was, I was cut off the other day when you absolutely went ballistic about my comparing these fracking people to Vietnam protesters and so forth. And the point is, I did not complete my thought. I basically was trying to say, psychologically, people can get angry when they feel they do not have the power and they have a political agenda that they want others to understand, and that's what the placards are for, and that's why people lie down in the street. And I mean, there's different degrees of this, and that's the thought I was trying to make. I wasn't trying to compare fracking or, you know, the pipeline in Addison County to the Vietnam War. My God, no. But I didn't get a chance to complete my my thoughts. That's all.
Well, thank you, Whit. I appreciate the phone call. You know, Whit, it's true that I did cut you off. Lines were full. I needed to move on. I thought you had made your point. I disagreed, obviously. You have clarified your point that about comparing the civil rights movement and the Vietnam protesters with the Addison County protesters. I just want to make sure that I get to everyone. You know, this isn't the Mike and Whit show. So I moved on, and if I get full phone lines, I do it again, because my hope is to get as many people on to the program as possible. My intention was not to cut you off. I thought you had made your point. I thought I had made my point, and then we moved on. And I think, Whit, thank you for the phone call. I really appreciate it. And let's go back to our subject matter, which is the Vermont State Employees Union. Sort of in chaos, and trying to get your thoughts about what the heck is going on there. Over the weekend, as I said, I got some documents that purported to be internal documents that are an indictment of leadership on Steve Howard and the organization's executive director, calling him in essence autocratic, inconsistent in decision making, and belittling to those that disagree with him. And I just, as I look at this, this is a mess. And as I said before, this is not something that I think is good for the organization or good for Vermont. There are many times, as I said, when I disagree with the direction of the organization, but state employees are good people. They're hardworking and they're dedicated, and they deserve to be represented by an organization that is not in chaos. And the other, at the same time, is this Steve Howard's fault? I mean, twice the organization has turned against the executive director, and one has to ask, is it the ED or the organization that's out of control? Would like your opinion about what's going on with the Vermont State Employees Association. It's not good. It's in chaos. It needs to be settled. Something has to be done. And that's something that I'd be interested in what you think has to be done in order to calm what is happening with the Vermont State Employees Association. Would welcome your calls at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Also, talking about what Ken from South Burlington brought up the other day when he called and raised the issue that there are more and more managers who are becoming political appointees and are not very good managers. I'd be interested if there's state employees out there that agree with Ken that there are more and more political appointees and they don't happen to be good managers. They don't give good guidance. They are all interested in the political aspects of it and not sort of where they should be focused is on the agency's priorities and direction. So give me a call at 802-244-1777 if you have a comment, or 877-291-8255. We're talking about the Vermont State Employees Association and political appointees. Should they be Should they be ones that should there be less state political appointees in government at the management level? Obviously, at the policy level, at the secretary level, you certainly need sort of political appointees. But Ken's comments is that that's starting to go down and down and down into the bureaucracy. So wondering what your thoughts are today in terms of the VSEA, what's happening with the VSEA, and political appointees, whether they are involved too much in the day-to-day running of state government. And the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Look, if I'll tell you where I think what the VSEA should do, and if you want to take my opinion, go right ahead. If you don't, that's fine as well. But I'm more interested in making sure that this mess is straightened out. From Steve Howard's point of view, I think he has to go from go back to some management principles that certainly I've developed over the 35 or 40 years that I've been in private and public sector at leadership levels. Look, you can be strong as a manager, you can be forceful, you can be demanding, but there are some things you need to do when you are doing that. Heaven knows I've been all of those things. I've been strong, I've been forceful, I've been demanding as a leader. But there are just some things you need to do. One of the core habits you need to do is you got to be honest. You can't play games. You can't tell people one thing and tell others something else. You can't avoid issues. That's the worst thing. Good news can wait. Bad news can't. Don't avoid issues. And don't assume all wisdom and seeking input, especially diverse input. It makes you stronger as a leader to hear that diverse input. And never prejudge anything. Oftentimes, the biggest mistake that leaders will make is that they prejudge who's giving the information. I wouldn't prejudge the information, because sometimes it's darn good information. And when we prejudge, where does that lead? It leads to prejudices that we shouldn't retain. And you know, we had this discussion before. I believe, and some of you don't agree with this, but I maintain that you got to remain loyal to those that work for and those that work for you. And number, you know, the next thing is don't be complacent. Don't think that, you know, where you are is ever in a good spot, because it's never in a good spot. You have to move on. We all know the stories of Wang Computer. They got complacent. Guess what happened? They're out of business. And those are, you know, there's a dime a dozen of companies that got complacent and got out of business. And there's some core skills of being a leader as well. You got to communicate precisely, and you got to listen intently. That's probably the biggest skill I think that you really have to do as a leader. And these are only suggestions to the VSEA for their leadership. You know, communicate precisely, listen intently, remain flexible and agile. You don't have all the answers. Sometimes you have to change directions. You got to be adept at handling crisis. You're in a crisis right now. You've got to be adept at handling crisis. And in times of crisis, do this. Slow down, think through the alternatives, and above all, don't rush or panic, and never lose your cool. There are some sort of Facebook postings that I think are on the edge of losing your cool that was in the packet that was sent to me this weekend. And, you know, also, you know, you should set realistic expectations and then meet them. And then among your employees, you got to encourage innovation and risk. And then if the person fails in pursuit of that objective, you got to back that person up. So that's sort of the leadership of the VSEA. That would be my advice. You don't have to take it, but that would be my advice as to what you should do in terms of the membership, in terms of those that are casting no confidence votes. What you've got to realize is what is the appearance from from the external appearance that you're giving. It looks like an organization in chaos. It looks like an organization that can't be managed. It looks like an organization that doesn't have a direction. And when you twice in the last few years try to get rid of the ED, the question that I have is it the ED or the organization itself? Would welcome your phone calls at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you doing today?
Great, thank you.
Good. Hey, listen, you got back on that bit about loyalty thing there, and I actually just want to throw in a bit of what I think is a correction here, in that you were saying that you thought people disagreed with you on loyalty and as far as being loyal to employers and being loyal to employees. And that's not at all, I know for sure, what I was addressing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the somewhere along the line is you can cross that border between loyalty and slavishness, where you just follow along with somebody, not for any particular reason, but simply because who they are, not because of what they are or the relationship with them. And that's what I thought would have been a better application when you were talking about Matt Dunn, and this goes back to a conversation you had about Matt Dunn a couple weeks ago.
Right. And just to remind everybody, Rama, just the conversation was Matt Dunn had come out in support of Bernie Sanders, and when in fact he used to work for the Clinton, well, President Clinton, during the Clinton years. Matter of fact, President Clinton gave him a job, and my response was, where's the loyalty? That was the conversation.
Right. And my comment on it was, well, it wasn't about loyalty because, first of all, Hillary Clinton didn't give him a job to start with. Second of all, Bill Clinton didn't give him a job, as he got a job hired in the administration. And that, you know, when we talk about our common politics, it's your political loyalties should be lying with somebody other than an individual. Because mm-hmm. when it lies with individuals, I can go through any long list of undesirable government despots that come to, you know, that can pop up throughout the history of the world. So I just, you know, I say that because oftentimes people hear what they want to hear said. Mm-hmm. And interpret it the way they want to, and it's so difficult at times. And I think this is probably something you know as being a successful manager of other folks over the years, is that you have to listen to what people are actually saying and interpret it how they intend it to be said. And so, you know, the bit about loyalty is not where is the loyalty between employers and employees, because I think that mischaracterizes what myself and some others said about that subject.
Okay. No, I thank you for calling and clarifying it. And you're absolutely right that communicating precisely and listening intently is a key core skill, Rama. I think that's one of the things that I think is important. Do you have any comments on this mess that's going on with the VSEA?
What I just said may in good part apply to what's going on in the VSEA, because I have in my life found out so many times that misunderstandings are more often just that, misunderstandings, and that, you know, once people understand where each other goes, they stop questioning each other's motives and they start listening to what each other's saying, that pretty much anything can get worked out when it comes to disagreements in a common organization.
Well, thank you for your call, and thank you for your comments. I certainly hope that's the case here, that the VSEA sort of works this out, be interested in other people's opinion about what's going on in the VSEA and what they should do to sort of work this out. I had talked about, you know, the core habits that maybe Steve Howard should try to institute as well as the core skills that he needs to try to institute, but also the organization itself needs to look itself in the mirror and ask itself, is it the ED or is it the organization having this problem? And one of the things that I hope they do is that they address it pretty rapidly here, because it you know, state employees are great people and they do a great job, and I want to make sure, you know, again, I can't believe I'm saying this because I disagree with the VSEA on multiple occasions, but I think they deserve an organization that's looking out for them. So would welcome your phone calls in terms of what's going on at the VSEA and your opinions on how they can straighten it out. The number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Bob in Calais. Bob, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, Mike? Hi.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm on speakerphone, hands-free here, so I'll have to speak up a bit.
It's the law, Bob. You got to do that.
Any questions? You know, I have a concern. You know, every manager, in my opinion, needs some guidance above them. I mean, you work for leaders, and they've given you guidance when you've had issues come up relative to management style and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this, I think it was 2012 that they had a change, that Howard came in.
Right.
But where's the executive board, from the standpoint of the executive board? I think, is there anybody on the executive board that has extensive management experience that can give guidance to Steve Howard? You know, and I think that when they have a turnover like that, there has to be some underlying issues relative to management above him. And they recognizing the issue and being able to address it. Now, I haven't seen documents and that type of thing, but that's just my opinion. I'll pass on that.
Okay, Bob, thank you for your opinion, and that's a very good, you know, the guidance aspect. Got to be a little bit careful. You do have guidance, whether it's a board of directors, whether it's a leader as a CEO, your president, or your executive director. You got to give parameters. You got to give guidance. That's right. You just can't overstep that to the date. You're being hired as a leader, so you can't overstep, you know, trying to second guess the leader. So I understand. I think you make a really good point in terms of what the board should be doing and how they should be doing it. They should be giving some guidance, some parameters. I don't know what's going on. I know it looks like a mess from the outside. Somebody's got to take control of this mess. Somebody's got to straighten out for the good of the state employees. Would welcome your phone calls at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Diane in Burlington. Diane, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi. A lot of our forefathers always said that public unions weren't a good idea because they're already represented, you know, by the government, and we the people are the employers, and you wouldn't want to have the government, you know, be adversarial with the people. That don't make sense.
Mm-hmm. No, I hear you, but I actually believe that they have a right to have somebody speak on their behalf. And frankly,
well, the whole legislature does, don't they?
I don't think so, because the legislature wasn't addressing their issues that they had this year. I think, you know, employees may have different issues than the legislature has. Employees may have different issues, and they certainly did when I was Secretary of Administration, had different issues than I was focused on. You know, I had my disagreements with them, but I still think they have a right to be represented. There are some good employees. Somebody's got to speak on their behalf, and I think, you know, having a functioning, well-run organization that represents employees, I don't think is all that bad. It's something that now, whether I agree with the issues or not that they're promoting, that's a whole different story. But having a functioning organization that represents state employees, I just don't think is all that bad, Diane. Thank you very much, Diane, for your phone call. I really appreciate it. We're talking about the VSEA and the mess that the VSEA is in right now, and asking, is there anything that should be done with this? Is there anything that you would recommend doing? I have given sort of my recommendation to both Steve Howard and the people that oppose Steve Howard in terms of what should be done. Be interested in your phone calls. When we come back, we'll continue Open Mic. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Before we go back to the phone lines, I just want to take a few minutes, probably about the next 8 or 10 minutes and talk with Rick Carlson, who's I'd like to welcome Rick Carlson to Open Mic. He's on the phone, and he is promoting a film that is being shown in Burlington tomorrow and a book about Vietnam. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. How are you?
Great, thank you. Can you tell us about both the book and the film, what they're about?
I can, but the first thing I want to say is that whenever somebody brings up the topic of the Vietnam War, you're opening up a world of sensitivity to people who have been so terribly affected by this dark period of American history. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing that I want to be clear about.
Okay.
It was difficult. This began for me 45 years ago when my brother-in-law was killed in the Vietnam War. After he died, six of us got together every 2 weeks for over 2 years and reviewed all the letters that he wrote to us and put them together in a manuscript. For the next 5 years after that, the manuscript was submitted to publishers on a first submission basis, and we collected a mountain of rejection letters. It then got shelved and collected dust.
Mm-hmm.
Last spring, I was given permission to publish it, and I did. And the book is now a book, and it's going to be released tomorrow.
And
Go ahead.
And the book's name is Calm Frenzy, One Man's Vietnam War. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And can you just tell, it's a collection of letters. Is that
the letters? Yeah, his name was Loring M. Bailey, Jr. We called him Ring.
Okay.
And it's the letters he wrote from training and through his time in Vietnam until he met his end. It's all written in the first person. It's absolutely riveting.
And you've received some both this and the film. Can you tell me a little bit about the film as well?
The film is directed by Soren Sorensen. Soren's father, Peter, was friends with Ring in both training and in Vietnam. And Soren, as he was growing up, finally asked his father about the Vietnam era, and his father opened up and told him the story. And Soren tracked down all these people involved. We follow four veterans from then till now and their families and their involvement. The film is only here for one day. The book is here forever, but the film is only here for one day, and that's tomorrow, Veterans Day. And we're showing it three times, 11, 2, and 7:30 in the evening at the Main Street Landing Performing Arts Center. That's on Lake Street in Burlington.
And how do you get tickets, Rick?
Well, they're available through Flintix through today and then at the door.
Okay, and how do you know how much it is to watch the film?
The tickets are $10.
Okay. And this film, as it follows sort of the, as it talks to the four people that were in Vietnam, and what's some of the conclusion that the film makes?
Well, that's a good question. The common denominator among almost everybody involved in the film is that, oh, my God, I haven't talked about this. The common denominator is nobody's asked me, nobody's wanted to know about this period, and people are pleased to release the demons that have been buried inside for so many years.
Do you think this is, Rick, do you think this is similar to the World War II generation? Because for years they did not talk about what they saw, what they did in World War II. Or is it the fact that this was such an unpopular war, nobody wanted to, the Vietnam War was such an unpopular war that nobody wanted to talk about it?
Yeah, it's funny, the relationship between this war and the World War II generation. The World War II generation were the parents and the fathers of these men who were young men who are faced with a draft. And Ring's father said, you know, if I'm going to be drafted, I just might as well enlist.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't a choice for many people but to go to war.
Right. I mean, not too many people realized that during the Vietnam War, there was, in fact, a draft going on. And, you know, it was a lottery draft depending on your birthday. You it was the luck of the draw whether you got drawn.
And before the lottery, they took everybody.
That's
you know, if I can, I can just mention that the male population of my graduating class from college was in 90% of the male population was in basic training within 2 weeks of commencement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was no lottery. There was no nothing. They took everybody.
And the book, if someone is interested, how would they get it?
The website is calmfrenzy, calmfrenzy.com.
Mm-hmm.
And just a note about the title. When Ring was in Vietnam, he was at a base called Landing Zone Liz. And they'd get fired on by the Viet Cong by rockets at night. And the next day, they'd get helicoptered to where the rockets were sent from. And in some of his final letters, he signed off on the letters from what he called the rocket pocket. He said, from the rocket pocket in a calm frenzy.
Hey, how was he killed, Rick?
A landmine.
So he stepped on a landmine?
The guy next to him stepped on it.
Okay. And what did you learn in terms of bringing all this, being one of the people that brought all this together? What did you learn out of this?
I'm still learning. And to be able to bring this story, because it's written in the first person, when you read the book, it's like it was written to you.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this book is to the Vietnam War what All Quiet on the Western Front was to World War I. It's a very direct story written right to you. And for me, to have this now as a book is truly cathartic. In that I'm getting it out, and the pain that I've carried over his death for 45 years, and my poor sister, he was her husband. It's a pain that's very difficult for her and continues to be, and so it's a cathartic experience. Between the book and the film, we're pulling back the curtain behind this very dark piece of American history.
And one more time, Rick, before you go, where do you get the tickets for the film? When is it showing? And where do you get the book? Could you go
Thank
over
you.
That one more
time? The film is showing three times tomorrow at 60 Lake Street at the Main Street Landing Performing Arts Center. It's showing at 11 a.m., 2 o'clock for a matinee, and 7:30 in the evening. You can get tickets either at the door or today at Flintix. Did that answer the question?
Yep. And where do you get the book?
We'll have the book there, or you can get the book at the website, which is calmfrenzy, calmfrenzy.com. All the details are there.
Well, Rick, thank you so much for being on Open Mic. I appreciate your time.
Well, I thank you for letting me talk about this.
Well,
you're very welcome.
Well, good luck with your book. Good luck with the movie. That is the book that Rick was talking about. Is called Calm Frenzy, One Man's Vietnam War, and the film is My Father's Vietnam. It's airing tomorrow at Main Street Landing. I'd like to give you a heads up too on tomorrow's show. Tomorrow, of course, is Veterans Day, which is tomorrow on Wednesday. This is going to be very interesting, I believe. We're going to speak with Tracy Squires Cheeks. Actually, it's Cheek. Her father, Jack Squires, a decorated Navy SEAL, was killed while he was overseas. And he was killed when she was a very small child. So since that time, she's tried to find out about her father and reaching out to discover who her father was. I came across Tracy when she contacted me it's years ago now, about the last 6 months of her father's life. In disclosure, I was deployed with Jack Squires when he was killed. We'll ask what Veterans Day means to her. It's a really compelling story about Tracy trying to find out about her father, and she'll be calling in tomorrow. And then we'll have a conversation with the daughter of Navy Captain Tim Holden, Christina Quinn, who was the Tim Holden, Captain Tim Holden, was the former head of all Navy SEAL operations on the West Coast. And many of you know, because I wrote in a column about him one just a little while ago, that he was tragically killed in a bicycling accident late August. She has a unique perspective because both of her parents were military officers, and she was a kid that moved a lot because of military services, And I want her to sort of give her perspective of what Veterans Day means to her. And then we'll open up the phone lines to anyone that wants to thank a particular veteran. And the reason I'm focusing on families is that because normally what we do on Veterans Day is thank a veteran or a current military member. But when you think about it, we really need to say thanks to more than just the veterans. Most of us never experience the long, sometimes dangerous time away from home and family that military members endure. I know that I was gone constantly, when I was in the military. It creates hardships that few of us understand, even if we can sympathize. It's extraordinarily difficult for servicemen and women to be gone for long periods of time. They miss holidays. There's milestones of the daily life of families that become unbearable. Even the technology that helps us, the Facebook, the Skype, the FaceTime, the Skype, all of those things, they still don't compensate for being gone. And besides the obvious danger, you know, when you contemplate life back home, it moves ahead without you. And that's sort of good and bad if you're a veteran. But, you know, the family members, well, they oftentimes feel left behind because they are left behind. They must manage the void. They must manage the day-to-day activities. They must care for the children. They got to keep the family together while the deployed loved ones focus on their jobs. I mean, that is such an important endeavor that they do. And they've got to put on this facade which hides the fear that can so impact them. And even when their loved ones come home, they don't know how they're coming home. They don't know the profound impact that an experience may have when the person comes home. And they may be vastly different from how they left to when they come home. Military service is dangerous. Of course it's dangerous. Living with the fear can be exhausting and can sometimes take its toll on people. The reality is that death or injury is never far from the minds of servicemen and women and their families. So military families always fear that car in the driveway or that knock on the door. So this Veterans Day, not only do I say thank a veteran, but take a moment to reflect on the incredible sacrifice that these veterans make, the men and women that are in uniform, but most importantly, and just as importantly, the families who stay by them so that they can serve and protect us with honor. I mean, think about this. They are home, and we owe them our gratitude and support. And we may not recognize this, but the children, too, sacrifice a lot. And I'll talk about this tomorrow with Christina, because they're required to move place to place every few years. And so they, too, soldier on. So for those, you know, we need to say thank you to the families and not only to the veterans. And there's all sorts of people we should thank as well. It's those from military chaplains to local ministers to aid and human service personnel to medical and mental health care workers who care for our military members, as well as those politicians that really think carefully and cautiously about sending troops into harm's way. You know, those are the things that we need to thank. And we also need to really pay attention to the lack of support our veterans here at home have. Some struggle with inadequate health care and suffer long waits and bogus statistics from the Veterans Administration bureaucracy, and who experience mental health, substance abuse, and domestic violence services that are just not acceptable. For those veterans, we should demand more. We have many thanks for our Veterans Day, but let's thank the veterans, and let's thank the families, and let's thank the people who support them. This is Welcome back to Open Mic. Tom, that commercial cracks me up every time. And just to give you a heads up, program-wise, on December 29th, Rusty DeWeese and I will be in this studio talking to teenagers about how to get their lives back on track and, you know, giving some advice. Teenagers obviously don't have to take it. They don't have to listen to people that are over, you know, 18. But it should be some good advice. So December 29th, Rusty DeWeese will be in studio with me, and we'll be talking to teenagers and their parents. And I want to go back to subjects. I had an opportunity to sort of catch up on my reading over the weekend. And on the political front, I see that there's another person thinking about running for lieutenant governor, who's the former editor of Politico in Washington, D.C. That's Garrett Graff. He's moving back to Vermont and exploring a run for lieutenant governor. But there's a hitch. Secretary of State Condos doesn't see how he qualifies because of the residency requirement. And Secretary of State Condos rightly admits that the only thing that he's taking this on is what he reads in the newspaper. And Mr. Graff says that he has ample proof that he is a resident, but he has been away from the state for quite a while in the D.C. area. And let me just say, just as a disclosure, I know Garrett Graff's father and mother. I know his father well. I don't know Garrett Graff at all. Many of you know his father, who is Chris Graff. And so let me just give you my sort of feelings on this and be interested in your feelings as well. The number to call in is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. If Garrett is listening, just to let you know, the presumption here is startling. The presumption that you can parachute in and run for an office, I think, is a distraction to the candidacy. That you can parachute into a state and run for office. I know you can do it in other states. I mean, other people, whether it's Buckley in New York in the 70s for the Senate, or it's Hillary Clinton for the Senate. I know people do that. But in Vermont, it seems like it comes across as being presumptuous to parachute in and now run for office. Give it a few years to do other things and then think about running for office. And I do think if you read the Constitution and other requirements for residency, I think he's got a residency problem. Now, you know, it would be different if he was in the service and was away, but I do think he has a residency problem. And the appearance is also something that I think he needs to think about it, because he's leaving a political news website that some, and I don't think, I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong, but some believe that's in the tank for the Democrats, and now he's running as a Democrat. He was the editor of that. And they want it. It just comes across as the appearance of it just does not come across right. So what's your opinion? Give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I think it comes across as presumptuous. I think he does have a residency problem. And the appearance, I think, going from the Politico to running for office has something that's going to cause people to give pause. What's your opinion on Garrett Graff running for lieutenant governor, coming back to the state and running for lieutenant governor? The number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Also this weekend, I was reading about Ben Carson and was wondering what you think about Ben Carson. Do you think basically what he's done? Politico had done a story about that he had said that he had gotten a scholarship to West Point. Obviously, there's no scholarships to West Point. He didn't get a scholarship to West Point, but he said that he was, you know, he said that this isn't what he meant when he said that. Also, it was in CNN said that they went to various people around his neighborhood to say whether he is to verify whether he tried to stab someone as a kid. Donald Trump is right on this one. I mean, it's amazing that you're saying that you tried to stab someone. People are saying, no, you didn't, and you're saying, no, you did, on this, and wondering. It's a strange election with Donald Trump, and Ben Carson in the lead, but he's come across back very, very strongly, saying that this stuff is a hack job, and he needs to attack this because the heart of his story is pulling himself up by the bootstraps, and that's a very compelling story. So the question is, he needs to show that he has integrity. He needs to show that the stories are true that he's told, because that is who he is, pulling himself up by the bootstraps. But my question is this: who's dumping this? Which campaign is dumping this opposition research? If you think this is coming out of nowhere, then it certainly is not. Remember Bernie Sanders? Remember the fact that all of a sudden Mother Jones started printing stuff about what he had written in the past? That just doesn't fall out of the sky. That isn't because somebody has dug in and done a lot of research. That means that the opposition research of a campaign has usually given this to a reporter. Not all times, but many times they're giving this to a reporter. So the question is, who is dumping this this information on? Which campaign is dumping this information about Ben Carson? I've been off on this campaign, especially on the Republican side, so much because I thought Ben Carson did not do well in any debate that he's been in, and after every debate, his poll numbers climb. So I can't figure this one out. And I don't believe that Donald Trump, except for the last one, had done very well in the debates. And again, their poll numbers climb after the debate. So it is really interesting. Who is dumping this? Is it a Republican challenger that's dumping this information off and leaking this information to reporters? Or is it the Democratic side who's worried about Ben Carson and wondering that they need to stop him, that need to attack his credibility? So just some of the stuff: VSEA, Garrett Graff, Ben Carson. Some of the things that we looked at this weekend. Up next, Dennis O'Brien for the group Concerned Catholics of Vermont. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM in Warren, 96.5 FM in Barrie, and 101.9 FM in Island Pond. We're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're going to go down to our friends and colleagues at Talk Radio News Service, to Bob, who's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Over the weekend, a lot of stuff happening with Ben Carson. I sort of teed it up before you got on the line here. He seemed to be a lot more aggressive than we've seen him in the past in terms of defending what amounts to be whether he stabbed somebody or not. So right. that's an interesting, usually you're saying you didn't stab somebody.
Exactly. Now I'm chuckling because, it even went beyond that, but you're right. I mean, it's the first time that in a long time somebody says, no, I did stab. So I did try to stab somebody, and I did try to do something to my mother versus denying it. But I also watched with fascination, really fascinating, to watch him say to the media, well, what about Barack Obama's record? Mm-hmm. Why me? Why don't you go after that? And the media guy said, well, what do you think's in there? And he said, don't ask me. Why don't you go after it? I just thought it was fascinating. There were also some overtones there not mentioned, but you could get the implication there that, you've got a Republican African-American president and a Republican African-American, I mean a Democrat president and African-American candidate, is he being treated unfair? I mean, there was some of that overtone there, too.
Yeah, and I thought he was pretty effective with that, actually.
I did, too.
Yeah, and
I certainly did.
And was what was amazing to me, and for all the listeners to know, in case you want to know, I was a horrible high school student, just so we get that out of the way, in case I want to make sure that this is the way things are now. You sort of talk about how horrible you were, and then, but, you know, the interesting thing with him is that that's what his story. He came from nothing. He came from a background that required toughness, and he changed. So I guess if you attack that, that is something that he needs to defend pretty vigorously, because that's the essence of who he is, right?
Yes, Carson wins on this one. And, you know, isn't it interesting? We talk about that. We can talk about the fact that Trump's like, wait a minute, hundreds of deals I did, yeah, I had 4 bankruptcies, but so what? We talk about that, yet there's nothing on our lips about Jeb Bush.
That's right, which is amazing to me. Mm-hmm. And as a result, he's sunk to, you know, 4-6%, whatever poll you look at.
Right.
It is missing. You know, the question I had, Bob, and I'm sorry to sort of dominate this, and I'll
anything you want.
Get back to it, but who's, you know, this doesn't just happen. You know, this story about his background just doesn't happen. This story about West Point just doesn't happen.
Right.
Somebody's dumping this information through opposition research.
Right.
Who's dumping it?
You know, it could be anybody. I ran, of course, you know, for 24 years in office, and started in the congressional level, and I'm not really proud to say this, but was forced into opposition research by, you know, people that I hired.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to do it. And then you sit there and you go, well, do you bring this out, or does somebody else bring this out? Usually campaigns do this, and it's sifted around. Now, we could get Machiavellian here and say that, you know, maybe somebody on the Democratic side did it. I don't know, but I assume it's probably coming out from various. It's sort of like the Kennedy theory of who killed him. I mean, it's probably coming out from various sources. I don't think that anybody believes it's just one.
So what else is happening in Washington now that we spent the bulk of our time talking about Ben Carson?
Well, the debate's, of course, tonight, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. But I did want to mention this. The president has lost round two on the immigration issue of whether he had the power to say 5 million illegal people are going to stay. He lost round two in the circuit court. I think this goes all the way to the Supreme Court. Won't be solved before he leaves. I did want to mention, too, you're seeing a more kinder and gentler Benjamin Netanyahu with President Obama. Our countries get along, but the fierceness of the dislike of Obama and Netanyahu for each other was spilling out over the sidewalks.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of seeing a more, you know, a little bit more gentler approach. I think there's a little bit of, you know, a mending process there between the two of them.
And what the Prime Minister of Israel was adamantly opposed was the Iran nuclear deal. I mean, that's still in play in terms of its being approved. Why the kinder, gentler?
He lost on Iran, and, you know, I knew from day one, the minute we did the deal in Geneva, it was over with. I don't care who did what, plus the Republicans messed up the entire process to undo that deal anyway. That's been done, and it's going to be done. The only alternative is for somebody to do a military strike, and you can bet we won't, and I don't think Israel will. So Netanyahu lost on it. I think this thing boiled over so bad, and the recent statements calling the president anti-Semitic, and Kerry has the mentality of a 12-year-old, and this was from Benjamin Netanyahu's guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in itself, somebody, I think, at higher levels of Israel must have said, look, Mr. Prime Minister, you got to do something. You know, he would lose.
Are we closing Gitmo and moving the prisoners to Colorado?
I can't imagine. You know, President Obama, day one, said he was going to close it. The Congress kind of wanted to do it. They don't want to do it. They put in the defense bill. You can't do it. I don't see where we're doing it.
Yeah, I saw an article over the weekend that said that may be in play, but I can't.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, I would suspect Congress. Both sides of the aisle, by the way.
It'll go crazy.
It would go crazy on
that.
Bob, anything else going on down there?
There's some judges that said the NSA has to stop bulk data collection. That'll be an ongoing thing. And, you know, you got Syria. Russia's still doing its thing over there. So that's about it for a D.C. wrap-up.
Hey, Bob. Thanks, as always. Thank I really appreciate the phone so call, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It is my pleasure to welcome to our Radio Vermont studios Dennis O'Brien of Concerned Catholics of Vermont. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Mike.
What are you concerned about?
Well, the simplest way to speak about concern, if you're a concerned Catholic, is that Catholicism is the largest single religious affiliation of people in the United States. The second largest is ex-Catholics. And if you look at the state of the church, we're all very concerned about the fact that it ain't continuing very well. Young people are not signing up. The number of priests in the diocese, this diocese, is declining. It's declining across the country, number of religious sisters and so forth. So you look at an organization which, from a business standpoint, looks as if it's on decline. And so if you're interested in Catholicism, I've spent a lifetime worrying about it, you want to see if something can change for the future. So we're concerned about the future of Catholicism in the United States and the world.
And how'd you become involved in Concerned Catholics of Vermont?
Well, it started off with a fellow by the name of Gary Chicoine, who got a hold of me and wondered if I was interested in joining an organization called Call to Action. And I won't go into that. And I said, well, I don't know, I've particularly not been terribly interested in Call to Action. But on the other hand, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is the old Inquisition, they gave it a nicer name, had just at that point started an investigation of Catholic nuns, of sisters in this country. Well, with all the troubles that Catholics have, they love the sisters. And of all the groups that you'd want to not attack if you were the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, it would be American Catholic nuns who are doing great things. So I was really annoyed. I would use other words except that this is a family program. And so I said, okay, I'll sign up. Let's see what we can do. Let's create something. Then we did Concerned Catholics. That's what we decided on our title.
You have a diverse background. Can you just give us a little snapshot of your background?
Well, I think the most interesting part of my background, first of all, my professional background is as a philosopher, a real thing. I have actually a PhD in philosophy, and most of the work that I've done, or a great deal of the work I've done, has been on the philosophy of religion, including several books I've written within the recent past on that subject. But my Vermont credentials are that I was dean of men, dean of the college, and dean of the faculty at Middlebury College for over a period of time. I had so many deanships that I was called dean of the world, and I noticed from reading the old Middlebury newspapers recently that at one point someone referred to me as dean of heaven and earth. And so and I'm back here in Vermont after I retired from being president of the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York, and happily serving on the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation with yourself and others. And so I'm delighted to be here. That's my background that I think is probably relevant.
And you're best known as Bess O'Brien's dad, right?
That is correct. I knew I had to get that in there somewhere. And so, Jay Craven's father-in-law.
Why did you become involved? Was it you need the Catholic religion needs change?
Yes, it certainly does need change. At least that's my view. There are really two large groups within the Catholic Church that look at it. One holds that it needs change. Others hold that it is absolutely unchangeable. And if there are problems such as the dropping away of so many Catholics from the faith, the problem is not with the faith. The problem is with secular society, with the media, you name a variety of different things. And so those are the two basic groups. One says nothing can change. The other one says, no, you really got to change something because this is not working. And you can take as an example the greatest blow to, I think, the continuation of the church was an encyclical from the Pope. An encyclical is simply an official letter from the Pope. I always think when I talk about encyclical, when Al Smith was running for president, the first Catholic to ever run for president, he was attacked in Harper's Magazine by someone who said, well, if you elect a Catholic as president, they'll follow all these encyclicals that the Pope have written. And Al Smith turned to Judge Roseman, who is his advisor, and said, hey, Judge, what's an encyclical? Encyclical was Humanae Vitae, was published in, I think, 1965, and it forbade the use of artificial contraception. This was a teaching from Rome which was just not received. At the present time, 85-90% of Catholics in the United States and across the developed world, at least, simply they practice contraception, artificial contraception, and that's bad enough, but they also don't think there's anything wrong with it. Mm. And so you either have to decide that something ought to change to accommodate or to understand that position, or you simply have to denounce those folks and say, sorry, folks, you've got the wrong religion.
We're speaking with Dennis O'Brien of Concerned Catholics of Vermont. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I'm starting to go through puberty, it looks like, here, as I'm losing my voice. You talked about concerns that Catholics have. The second largest religion are ex-Catholics.
Right.
What do you think has driven those people away from the Catholic Church? You talk about, one was contraceptives that we talked about.
I would say that if you had to generalize on specific issues, there would be the whole range of the so-called sexual issues, the sexual morality, the hot-button issues, attitude towards homosexuals, the questions of abortion. One of the issues that was very big on the recent synod was what's the status of divorced Catholics who have remarried. And so as you go through those, the status of irregular arrangements, young people these days are living together without the benefit of official matrimony, either from the state or the church. So that it seems to me it's the sexual issues. Even deeper than that, there is, in fact, a secular trend where people find it harder and harder to make sense of, quote, supernatural ideas and the whole notion of God and so on. And that's even more fundamental. But probably you need a longer program for that one. Stick to sex.
Yeah. We'll definitely have call-ins on that.
That's right.
Why do you think Vermont is – I think it's one of the – if not the, it's in second place as the least religious state in the country. And I understand there's a difference between religion and spirituality, but
sure.
Why do you think that sort of tag is on Vermont?
Well, it's just a fact because people have done surveys to find out how many people actually go to church. It's a pretty highly educated population. It's a liberal politically, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, a Republican in this country, in this state, looks pretty darn liberal. I mean, Jim Douglas, an old friend of mine, he looks like a wacko on the left from some of the people we hear about from the right in the Republican Party. And that particular stance, educated people, I think, more and more have difficulties with traditional religions. And one of the reasons is the traditional religions, and particularly the Catholic Church, is one that says, we know all the truth and we're going to tell it to you. Mm-hmm. And if you've gone to Middlebury College, where I taught and so forth, or University of Rochester, they're going to say, you've got to dialogue about things. You've got to think about things. Don't just accept things because somebody says that's the way it is. So I think it's the questioning attitude of intellectuals that it makes it difficult to take a religion which claims to be very dogmatic and very doctrinaire.
Why are you a practicing Catholic?
Well, it's part of a family loyalty. If your name is Dennis O'Brien, you don't really have another choice. And I was educated by the Christian Brothers of Ireland, as they were called. I like to say about that, it gave me an early appreciation of the Irish interest in terrorism. But no, more seriously, I was very I left the happy home of the Irish Christian Brothers to go to Yale. That was quite a shock because I had lived, I'd been grown up in a Catholic environment, Catholic sisters, Catholic brothers, and all of a sudden you're at Yale. And they weren't all Catholic. And you got this challenge to things. And I really was concerned about that and was so concerned. I took several courses on the subject when I was an undergraduate. And when I graduated from college, I wanted to be a priest. I mean, I really was into it. And in fact, my ambition at that time was to become the Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago. I once told Cardinal George, the then Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago, that's what I wanted to be. He looked a little startled, I must say. But it's the intellectual challenge, of course, that's interested me. That's why I finally studied philosophy and have written a great deal about it, because it's quite clear that intellectuals have a hard time with religion in general, and Catholicism often in particular. It's been said that anti-Catholicism is the anti-Semitism of the intellectuals. That's a statement by Peter DeVries. And that's something I've tried to deal with all my life.
So how do you change? How do you change the Catholic Church? What's the mechanism to change the Catholic Church?
Well, that's an interesting question. The great Catholic sociologist Andrew Greeley said that the Catholic Church reforms by amnesia. And if you look at the history of the church, there are all kinds of things that the church, quote, taught in the past with absolute certainty that they don't pay any attention to at all anymore. So one of the ways, history simply passes you by and things get forgotten. But if you really want to have active change, it is a very hierarchical structured church. And you can, in fact, start change at the very top. So now you have a pope who is evidently interested in some sort of a change. He's already changed the style of the papacy from his two immediate predecessors. So one of the ways you might hope you get change would be change from the top. It's much more difficult to get change from the bottom in Catholicism, although they like to talk about it. It doesn't usually happen that way.
We're speaking with Dennis O'Brien, who is from the organization Concerned Catholics of Vermont. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. When we come back, Dennis, what I want to talk about is changing from the bottom up and talk about
good luck.
That. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Dennis O'Brien, who's of the organization called Concerned Catholics of Vermont. If you wish to join our conversation, if you're a concerned Catholic, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Please do, and give us a call and join the conversation if you're concerned Catholic. If you're one of those Catholics that have left the church, please tell us why you've left the church and what are the reasons why you've left the church as well. So I'd be interested in your opinions as we talk with Dennis O'Brien, who is with Concerned Catholics of Vermont. Dennis, we talked about change at the top level. Pope can make tremendous changes or, to some extent, you know, he runs into bureaucracy as well.
Right.
The bank is one of the things that I'm seeing that he's running into some bureaucracy with, especially when they've been accused of laundering money. But the issue of how does the common Catholic, how does the Catholic parishioner change the Catholic Church?
Well, that is a unsettled problem. This recent synod that completed in Rome on October the 25th reached out in a rather awkward way toward the guy in the pew. The synod was a meeting of Catholic bishops. There were 270 Catholic bishops from around the world. That's Asia, Africa, Europe, South America, and so forth. And they came together, and the subject matter for their conversation over the last 2 years was going to be the status of the family. That's fine. Well, none of those guys has a family. I mean, they are certainly all raised in a family, but none of them has a family in the sense in which I have a family and you have a family. And it was the intent of this particular pope, and this is very interesting, to open up the discussion. With the bishops themselves. So the bishops have argued a lot over the last 2 years. Then on top of that, a questionnaire was put out to be distributed to Catholic organizations, individuals, and so forth throughout the world. Here in Vermont, Bishop Coyne did distribute the official document that came from Rome to get responses. Unfortunately, it was only barely translated from the Latin. I mean, it was really supposedly be in English, but the church has this way of saying things you can't figure out quite what they say. So the responses were not very good. In England and Wales, however...
Like consubstantial. What does that mean?
How long have we got? In England and Wales, the bishops in that country, those two jurisdictions, prepared a special kind of a questionnaire that was actually distributed to people and to organizations, and then they published a report about what was in it. And so it was a real attempt to reach right down into the pews and say, what are your views about the issues before the Synod?
We're speaking with Dennis O'Brien from the Concerned Catholics of Vermont. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Kevin in Stowe. Kevin, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hey, thank you. I've been listening to your conversation. I'm a Catholic, and I felt compelled to call in and say that I don't agree with one man. This guy says I don't know where you found him, but I just don't understand what he's talking about. Thank you.
Well, that's one side of the issue, and that gentleman, his position was very well articulated, I think, by the conservative part of the Catholic Church in the recent synod, and that's the view that Catholic Church is the Catholic Church. It's always been the same, and there's no reason to worry about the change in the Catholic Church. It shouldn't change. It is unchangeable. And I suspect that that's what that gentleman feels, and he will have a lot of bishops and many priests who will agree. On the other hand, there are many people, if you look at the statistics, as I say, you have the choice, take the contraception issue, which was not really discussed at this meeting. If you have a situation where 80 or 90% of the Catholics, say in the United States, not only practice artificial contraception, but disagree with the moral evaluation of it. The majority of Catholics in this country, in the pew polls, for instance, accept gay marriage. The church does not accept gay marriage. Now, you have a choice, as Kevin has got the choice of either saying, all those people are just wrong, they should really be real Catholics, or saying, maybe these people are testifying to a reality which we haven't quite grasped as a church. So either they're just morally incorrect, or maybe there's an experience which homosexuals have or the people have with the utilization of contraception which the church should learn from. And that's the position I'd be on.
Whatever happened to limbo?
Limbo went out at the end of Vatican II.
We're speaking with Dennis O'Brien, who is with the organization Concerned Catholics of Vermont. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone line and Jack in Hyde Park. Good morning, Jack. You're on open mic.
Good morning. As a former Catholic who left the church when I moved to Vermont because I couldn't stand listening to them begging for money every week, came from a parish in Massachusetts that didn't do all the begging, and they raised more money that way. And I found that when the parishes were run by the council, parish council instead of by the priest, people got more involved. And when I mentioned this to people up here, they were horrified when I said that they should change their ways.
Well, what do you say?
Yeah,
Dave?
I agree that it's been a very imperfect sort of change. The idea out of Vatican II was that the church would become more collegial. The church, after Vatican II, was referred to as the people of God, and that everybody was at the same level in one sense, even the priesthood of all believers, people in the church. And so the idea of having parish councils, diocesan councils, and so forth, and having the lay people really participate in the work of the church is something that came out of Vatican II. Not everybody bought into that, including a lot of priests and bishops. So it didn't quite take, but it was all there in the Second Vatican Council.
So Bishop Coyne is a relatively new bishop here in Vermont. What are you seeking as Concerned Catholics of Vermont? What are you seeking from him?
Well, we've met with the bishop, and it was a very friendly and very open discussion. He is, in my judgment, a bishop very much in the mode of Pope Francis, in the sense that the first thing he wanted to do was to go around and listen to what Catholics in the various parishes were saying. So he's made a business of going around to parish after parish after parish and meeting with people and saying, what's on your mind? That's a very different style of being bishop than many other bishops have, who say, I will tell you what you're supposed to think. And not that the bishop doesn't, he's not going to, the church is not a democratic organization in that sense. But it is important to listen to people. When the Pope spoke to the Congress 2 or 3 weeks ago, the thing he talked about was dialogue. I want to dialogue with you. And I think Bishop Coyne buys that completely. I want to dialogue with you. I'm not going to dictate to you. I want to dialogue with you. And that's the side of the church that I believe is necessary.
Is there a formal way of having that dialogue where you include everybody and take the recommendations from that group?
Yes. In fact, one of the things that we, when Bishop Angel was the bishop, that's about 15 years ago, I talked to him and did some of my colleagues about having a synod of the diocese. You don't have to, synods don't have to be international. You can have a local synod. Bridgeport, which has a brand new bishop, Bishop Caggiano, first thing Caggiano did when he got there was to say, I'm going to have a synod of the diocese, which will involve a very broad array and deep array of people, lay people, priests, and everybody else. And then they go through issues that are facing the diocese and make a series of recommendations, some of which can be taken care of by the bishop, some of which you may have to say, gee, that's a nice recommendation, but I can't decide that. It's got to be decided at a higher level. But that's the way you do it. You do it through a synod. It's the official way to do it.
We're speaking with Dennis O'Brien, who's with Concerned Catholics of Vermont. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Rick in Essex. Rick, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yes, I have a question that I'd like to ask, and then I'll listen to the response off the air. But I'm just, I find this conversation kind of curious. And I guess my question is, Mr. O'Brien's beliefs seem possibly more in line with, let's say, just for example, the Episcopal Church or maybe the Lutheran Church, and just wondering why he continues to remain a Catholic when, as opposed to moving to a church that is more in line with his beliefs and encouraging fellow Catholics to move with him. Looking forward to his response.
Well, I was born and raised a Catholic, and as someone who has tried to understand the history of the Catholic Church, I think that what I would be saying is part of the very deep history of the Catholic Church itself. And part of the problem with conservatives, as I suspect you are, is that they don't look very long and deeply into the actual history of the Church. The Church is a very various, complex organization. And you can find people who sound like Episcopalians or Lutherans or whatever else you want, Buddhists or Catholic Buddhists and so forth, within the Catholic fold. The pleasure of the Catholic Church is the fact that it is so broad and so complicated and so often contradictory. I have greatest respect for Episcopalians, Lutherans, and so forth. I have preached in every religious denomination that I can think of, except the Catholic Church, because lay people are not allowed to preach in the Catholic Church. So I have great appreciation, but they all tend to be somewhat sectarian. That is, you're being a Lutheran or this. You could be a Lutheran Catholic. You can be an Episcopal Catholic. You can be all kinds of Catholics. And it seems to me a shame to try to restrict Catholicism to some particularly smaller cultic, if I may say so, or sectarian view. It's just too complicated. James Joyce, the great Irish author, said, Catholic Church, here comes everybody.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dennis O'Brien, who's with Concerned Catholics of Vermont. We'll return to the conversation in just a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Dennis O'Brien, who's from the organization Concerned Catholics of Vermont. We were speaking just a minute ago about convening the synod to talk to the bishop about various things that are of concern right. to Catholics. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I just want to just quickly talk about what has been the bishop's reaction to that request.
We asked the bishop, indicate we would like to have a synod for the diocese, and he has said he would make up his mind about that after he's had a year here to talk to people to find out whether that would be a good idea. But he's not said no at all, and it's I think, a subject he's seriously considering.
Let's go to the phone lines, and let's go to Molly in Essex. Molly, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I would like to mention a few things. One is that both of you laughed at the idea of consubstantial and purgatory, and I find that offensive as a Catholic, because there are doctrines held by the Catholic Church. Consubstantial means the same substance, that's all. And purgatory, yes, purgatory didn't go out with Vatican Council. It stayed.
Yep.
And purgatory is basically the cleansing of the soul before it meets Christ. It's a state of being.
Let me just, Molly, thank you for the phone call, but let me just explain. The word consubstantial was a new word that came in maybe about a year or two ago into the readings. And I got to tell you, I'm a practicing Catholic. So when I saw that word, I said, what does this mean? Where does this come from? So I wasn't criticizing the word. It was just a word that came out of nowhere all of a sudden. And as you know, Molly, there were different changes to the Mass that came in a few years ago that all of us were scratching our heads saying, what does this mean? What does this word mean? Second of all, I think it was limbo that I was talking about. As a kid, I've always, you know, was told about limbo. I never thought limbo was fair. And limbo is the place where kids that weren't baptized went.
That's right. If you weren't baptized, you went to limbo.
Right. And I always thought, to be
nice
honest.
Nice place, but.
Yeah. I always thought, Molly, that was not fair for the kids because it wasn't their fault. They were just too young before they died. So I wasn't laughing. What I was doing was explaining that there are some things that change in the Catholic Church, and those changes sometimes are difficult for people to understand, but at the same time, change does occur, Dennis.
Well, it used to be that you were trying to assert that Jesus and the Father were one in substance. That was what the old language was. When they revised the Missal a couple of years ago, somebody got hepped on Latin and used the word consubstantial, which is a Latin word. I don't think it means anything different than one in substance. The problem is, really, what do you mean when you say that Jesus, a man, is one in substance with God? And that's a long conversation beyond the scope of this morning's conversation, but that's where consubstantial came from.
It takes years sometimes for the Catholic Church to change.
Right.
What gives you hope that what you're talking about will, in fact, happen?
A great deal depends on this particular pope, because he has changed the way in which the conversation of Catholics is changed. For years, for instance, the councils of the church, the First Vatican Council, the Council of Trent, you go right back through all the councils, were set up in terms of this is what you must believe. If you do not believe this, you are anathema sit. You are outside the church. And the Vatican Council is the same way. The Second Vatican Council was, let's talk about religion. Let's talk about the Catholic Church. This Pope wants to do that. As I said, he opened up his remarks to the Congress by saying, I have come here not to dictate, not to tell you what's right or wrong, but to ask you to dialogue with me about very important issues like climate change and so on, income inequality. These are important. It's an important change when you begin to talk to someone in a different tone of voice. So in my judgment, Francis has really created in himself a revolution in the way in which the church wants to approach people. Not, I am going to tell you, but you tell me about yourself. And then maybe we can converse with one another and discover what we have in common. That's a radical change in the church.
Do you expect this change?
The question will be who succeeds.
In our lifetime.
Well, the question is who will succeed Francis? Mm-hmm. Because the bishops which were appointed by his two predecessors have a rather different view, and they approached issues often in a very different way. The doctrines were the same, but they were much more, example of John Paul II, who's been sainted, when it came to the question of the ordination of women, he simply said, that is not even to be discussed. Mm-hmm. Well, if it's not going to be discussed, that sort of closes the door. I don't know that Francis is anxious to discuss the ordination of women, but his whole manner is one in which I want to dialogue with you, whether you're homosexual or whatever your problems are. I want to understand where you're living. And then maybe we can find out where Christ speaks to you.
The process, I heard one bishop say, and maybe it was a cardinal that said, this is bigger than just one pope, and he was a conservative cardinal.
Yeah.
That doctrine is bigger than one pope. So how can a pope change if he has an infrastructure that is resistant to that change?
Well, first of all, this particular pope would agree with that in the sense that's why he had a synod. In other words, just standing up and saying, I'm going to do this. He really wanted to have people dialogue. And what we found out from the meeting in Rome of bishops and cardinals over the last 2 years is that there are very profound differences within the among the cardinals and the bishops. That's a significant change from anything that's happened since the Vatican Council 50 years ago.
Where could people find out more about your organization?
Well, you can look up under Concerned Catholics of Vermont, or our website is GM Catholics, that's for Green Mountain, gmcatholics.org.
And you're having a meeting coming up. What is that about, and what do you hope to accomplish?
There'll be a meeting. If you disagreed with what I had to say or the drift of my remarks today, you can come and disagree with me in person, as a matter of fact, because Concerned Catholics of Vermont is having a meeting at St. Michael's College on this Saturday at 1 o'clock at St. Edmund's Hall, and our aim is to discuss the issues about the family that were brought up in the recent synod that closed in Rome on October the 25th. So there'll be an opportunity to talk about these issues.
And I learned something, not to joke about various things in religion here or get calls to talk about things. So I won't joke about limbo again, although as a kid I still found it confusing. So thank you, Dennis, so much. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Mike.
I just want people to know, again, tomorrow's show is Veterans Day, and on Veterans Day I wanted to go over some of the this show is, I think, meaningful because we're talking to kids of veterans who have passed away. First, we'll be speaking with Tracy Squire Cheek. Her father, Jack Squires, a decorated Navy SEAL, was killed while overseas, and she was a small child when he was killed. And some of the discovery that she went through to learn about her father, I think you'll be fascinated with, and also the fact of what veteran
Veterans Day means to her. And then we'll talk with the daughter, Chris, daughter of Captain Tim Holden. And her name is Christina Quinn. Tim Holden was the former head of all Navy SEAL operations, and he was tragically killed in a bicycle accident. The reason why Christina is, I'm interested in hearing Christina, is both of her parents were in the military, and she was a kid that moved around a lot. And then, of course, I really want to hear from you and who you want to thank for Veterans Day. As I said, there's a lot of people to thank, the family, the veterans themselves. Obviously, the veterans themselves is number one. But I want to hear from your phone calls and who you want to thank in terms of a veteran. So that's what's coming up tomorrow. I think you'll enjoy the show. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM in Warren, 96.5 FM in Barrie, 101.9 FM in Island Pond. I want to thank our guest, Dennis O'Brien from the Concerned Catholics of Vermont today. And we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. This is Mike Smith, and we'll talk again tomorrow.